Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Wild Hour editorial review. The Wild Hour is sponsored by the Wooden Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on famine coming to America right after this. You know, the genocidal policy of Global 2000 and this New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. And that's not just my opinion either. You know, Jesus of Nazareth held the same view when he said in Matthew 24, verse 22, that except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive. Now, there are 64 of these life-threatening problems described in the Scripture detailing this New World Order and their Global 2000 genocide agenda. And the Scripture teaches preparation for this great tribulation, not apathy and indifference. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Israel and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. You know, politicians like Ted Kennedy, Arlen Specter, Hillary. Now, let's prepare to live through and survive this Global 2000 New World Order nightmare. To do just that, why don't you call, write, or email the law school and ask for those 64 life-threatening problems from the Scriptures, and let's talk about formulating a real and a meaningful, intelligent plan to survive Global 2000 and these other 64 life-threatening problems called the Great Tribulations in Scripture. Now, why don't you call and order the free General Law CD package first? Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, my subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, as I mentioned last time, when we talk about famine, especially those Americans, for those of us that are Americans, we think in terms of famine, relief. What do we do to help the people of Ethiopia, or the people of Chad or Niger, or some far-flung African country, you know, third world country where people are starving to death, and, you know, what can we do to help them? I'm not talking about famine in Ethiopia. I'm talking about famine in New York, California, Florida, and North Dakota. Now, we've never experienced anything like that in the United States, but the public policy of the United States is aimed at producing famine in this land. I mentioned that to you last time. We were talking about public policy, and I showed you the population and the methodologies that we're using here in America to distribute food and the use of land and water and how much land is being lost to erosion and how much land is being lost to urban development. Now let's take a look at a second aspect of the public policy, which is guaranteed to bring upon us a result, just like the public policy of the 20s and 30s gave us a report or a final conclusion as it relates to oil. The oil policy of the 20s and 30s has given us the results that we now live with in 2005. And the public policy that we follow in the United States concerning food is going to deliver to us a result in the same way that it has delivered a result in China and India and Russia and every place else in the world. Now, I'm not going to change that. I'm not here to tell you that you ought to march on Washington or write your senator a letter. Your senator isn't going to listen to you anyway. So writing him a letter is a waste of your time. It's the old adage of you ought not to waste your time trying to teach a pig to sing. It just wastes your time and it annoys the pig. But when famine comes, it's going to affect you and it's going to affect me. So I'd like to know in advance what the public policy is and what the probable results are going to be so that I can take the appropriate action to provide for myself. And I just saw in the International Forecaster, he said, if trends continue, the price of oil in 2006 will be $100 a barrel and the price of gasoline will be $17 a gallon. Okay, I think the guy's probably right. Unless some public policy changes, unless some competitive factor is factored in, like, gee, let's go follow the governor of Montana and let's start making gasoline, diesel, and aviation fuel out of coal by using German technology pioneered in the 1920s, unless we do something like that, which isn't very likely to happen. Public policy takes a long time to change. But unless we do something like that, the peak oil problem. That is, the world now is pumping all the oil in the world that it can possibly pump out of the ground to supply demand. And it's developing into a shortage. And so that bids up the price. And when the price of oil hits $100 a gallon, he's saying they'll be charging $17 a gallon. Now, gasoline's over $3 a gallon out in California. I think the other day I saw it's $2.67 a gallon here. Now, that being the case, let me introduce you to a public policy that has been adopted in this country that is described in a book called Seeds of Deception by Jeffrey M. Smith, exposing industry and government lies about the safety of the genetically engineered foods that you're eating. Now, genetic modification of seed is a direct violation of the scripture. It violates Leviticus 19, verse 19. Now, we've been doing that for a long time with hybridization, but now we've gotten to the point where we're going to do it on an industrial scale called genetic engineering or genetic modification. And there's going to be a side effect that comes from it. Like taking a drug, you get side effects. Now, here's a lesson from overseas. A biologist over in Scotland by the name of Arpad Pusztai was more than just good at his work. In other professions, they'd call him great, but in the conservative and exacting world of experimental biology, this accolade given was through Pusztai's thoroughness over 50 years that had put him at the top of his field. He had published nearly 300 scientific articles, authored or edited 12 books, and regularly collaborated with other leading researchers around the world. Well, in 1995, Arpad and his wife Susan, who was also a distinguished senior scientist, and colleagues at the Rowett Institute, Scottish Crop Research Institute, and the University of Durham School of Biology, were awarded a £1.6 million research grant by the Scottish Agriculture, Environment, and Fisheries Department. Selected over 27 other contenders, this consortium of scientists, with Arpad Pusztai as their coordinator, was chosen to create a model for testing genetically modified foods, verifying that they're safe to eat. Their testing methods were to become the standard used in Britain and likely adopted throughout the European Union. Well, at the time of the grant, no research yet had been published on the safety of genetically modified foods, and the world scientific community had plenty of questions and concerns. Pusztai and his team, therefore, were charged with designing a testing regimen that would create confidence and, of course, be thorough. The team's research had been underway for about 2 years when, in April of 1998, the Rowett Institute's director, Professor Philip James, walked into Pusztai's office and placed a sizable stack of documents on his desk. He called in Susan from the adjoining office, and he told the Pusztais that ministers from throughout Europe were about to meet in Brussels, Belgium, to cast their votes regarding regulation of genetically engineered foods. The documents were submissions from biotech companies seeking approval of their own varieties of GM soybeans, corn, and tomatoes. The British Ministry of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries was attending the conference and needed a scientific basis with which to recommend them. Professor James was one of 12 scientists who comprised the Advisory Committee on Novel Foods and Processes, which was responsible for evaluating genetically modified foods for sale in Great Britain. James was in charge of the nutritional analysis. Pusztai looked at the stack of papers. There were about 6 or 7 folders, each representing a different request for approval, nearly 700 pages in all. Pusztai knew that James and the other 11 members would never actually read these documents themselves. Well, how soon does the minister need his recommendations? Asked Pusztai. 2.5 hours, said James. Well, Pusztai and his wife quickly got to work. They divided the submissions and focused right in on the most substantial evidence in the documents, the research design, and the data. Well, as Pusztai looked first at one submission and then another, he was flabbergasted. As a scientist, he said, I was really shocked. This was the first time that I realized what flimsy evidence was being presented to the committee. There was missing data, poor research design, and very superficial tests indeed. Theirs was a very unconvincing case, and some of the work was really very poorly done. And I want to impress upon you that it was a real shock. Whereas Pusztai and his wife originally thought that 2.5 hours would be enough only to give the minister preliminary recommendations on the submissions, it turned out to be more than enough time to give him an answer with confidence. The research presented was in no way adequate to demonstrate that the genetically modified foods described were safe for human or animal consumption. All of them failed to produce sufficient evidence, and Pusztai made the phone call. I told the minister on the basis of what we had seen so far, even with just 2.5 hours of review, I advised him to be extremely cautious and not to accept it. And then he said something on the phone which I found really amazing. He said, quote, I don't know why you're telling me this. Professor James has already accepted it, unquote. Well, Pusztai was stunned.
It turned out that not only had the committee approved the GM food submissions based on flimsy evidence, the approvals had taken place 2 years earlier. James had only wanted some scientific assurances for the ministers to use at the committee hearing and then later for the vote. And neither Pusztai nor other scientists working in the field or the more than 58 million people of the United Kingdom knew that they were already eating GM tomatoes, GM soybeans, and genetically modified corn, and that it had been in the food supply for almost 2 years. The approvals had all been done under the cloak of secrecy. Well, the incident was a turning point for Pusztai. Up until then, he had been confident that the scientific and regulatory community would carefully and thoroughly scrutinize this new technology, but now he was concerned. In fact, he was very concerned. Well, after the call, Pusztai talked to Professor James and told him why he thought the committee's approval of the foods was a mistake, and he said that there were critical pieces of evidence missing and described how the model that his team had developed with their own research was many times more rigorous and detailed than that which was presented to or by the biotech companies. Already he was seeing some evidence of dangers in the potatoes that he was studying that would not have been picked up in the superficial research done on genetically modified tomatoes, corn, and soybeans. Professor James was not defensive of the committee's decision. In fact, he was supportive of Pusztai's conclusions, even enthusiastic. If scientists at this institute had created a better way to test GM foods, he reasoned, this could result in very lucrative contracts, millions of pounds pouring in to the institute for their research. He thought it was a good opportunity to get more funds for scientific research, said Pusztai. Now, you understand that we are all strapped for cash, all academics. He thought that we should carry on with this research and come up with some really great things. Pusztai, on the other hand, was not enthusiastic. He had serious concerns about the untested GM tomatoes, soy, and corn that's already being sold in grocery stores. This was compounded by the fact that he knew that soy, corn, and their derivatives are found in about 70% of all processed foods. So as Pusztai continued his research, his concerns about genetically modified food intensified. Now, there's the beginning of the GM story back in the 90s in Europe. They have, by and large, across the board in Europe, rejected genetically modified foods, period. There's still some there milling around, but they're in the process of getting rid of it. The only place in the world that genetically modified food is being enthusiastically welcomed is here in the United States, and it's not being welcomed by people. People don't know anything about it. It's being enthusiastically welcomed by the multinational corporations like McDonald's and Burger King, and by Heinz and all of these food processors and manufacturers that stand to make profits from the new technology. But is this new technology good for you and me? I would contend that the answer to that is no. I avoid it like AIDS, herpes, and VD. I'm not here to tell you what to do or how to live with it, but let me show you on page 267. Now, this is a book published, and this is called Seeds of Deception. I'm not going to review this book this week. I just wanted to hit a couple of highlights in the book here in this second program to alert you to the fact that genetic manipulation of seed, which is a violation of Leviticus 19:19, and it violates a number of other health laws in the scripture, including the agricultural production laws, which I'm not going to get into per se, but I wanted to point that out. The results from this process or project is going to be famine. Now, God has told us in the Bible 101 times about the story of famine. The word famine is used in the Bible 101 times. He's told us two or three stories about famines, and then he's given us a prophecy. In fact, there's 30 prophecies in the Bible that deal with the end times, that deal with the Great Tribulation. This Great Tribulation deals with Israel primarily, not Judah, not those people sitting over in Israel that we call Jews today. We're talking about the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the four brothers that came out of Great Britain, the four of us. We're about to have our butts kicked. And one of those facets to the Great Tribulation is called famine, which is the subject matter of this week's program. Famine. Now, while we have not seen famine in the United States, Canada, Australia, or New Zealand, we're about to. And we're about to not because we Americans, Canadians, and Australians, and New Zealanders can't produce food, or we've lost our technique, or we don't know how, or we never knew how, or we were always third world dependent nations depending upon handouts from somebody. It's public policy. It's governmental public policy that's bringing it upon us. Just like governmental public policy has brought upon us this oil shortage and peak oil. It's not because the world is short of energy or short of oil. It's because of the public policy that surrounds it. Now, let me turn to page 267 and let me show you something. You are right now eating genetically modified foods. Now, when I say you are, probably you're avoiding them as best you as you possibly can, but maybe you better be thinking about what it is that you are eating here. Now, listen to this. Currently commercialized GM crops in the United States, soybeans, 80% of the soybeans used in the country are GM. Cotton, 70%, canola, 60%, corn, 38%, Hawaiian papaya, more than 50%, zucchini and yellow squash, there's a small amount, and tobacco, Quest, the registered trade brand. Now, I don't know if you knew this or not, but if you take soybeans, canola, and corn, those three products are used in just about everything that's manufactured. So if you're eating out of the supermarket, you're eating GM foods. Those of us that don't eat out of supermarkets, which there's, I don't know, 10 or 15 of us in the country, probably, we don't have that problem because we're not eating genetically modified soybeans, corn, or canola. And that canola oil, by the way, isn't fit for a pig, so you might want to consider changing in your diet to olive oil, which is the best. It's also the most expensive. Always keep in mind that the most expensive food is the best food for you. So whenever I have a choice to make, and there's two different prices, I always take the more expensive. If I don't know the science behind it, the more expensive is probably going to be better for me. Now, here's other sources of GMOs. Dairy products from cows that are injected with RBGH, food additives, enzymes, flavorings, and processing agents, including the sweetener aspartame, NutraSweet, and rennet used to make hard cheeses. In addition to meat, eggs, and dairy products from animals that have eaten genetically modified feed, honey and bee pollen that may have GM sources of pollen. Now, some of the ingredients that may be genetically modified in your food supply is vegetable oil, soy, corn, cottonseed or canola, margarines, soy flour, soy protein, soy lecithin, textured vegetable protein, cornmeal, corn syrup, dextrose, maltodextrin, fructose, citric acid, and lactic acid. And some of the foods that may contain GM ingredients are things like infant formula, salad dressing, bread, cereal, hamburgers and hot dogs, margarine, mayonnaise, cereals, crackers, cookies, chocolate, candy, fried food, chips, veggie burgers, meat substitutes, ice cream, frozen yogurt, tofu, kamari, soy sauce, soy cheese, tomato sauce, protein powder, baking powder, alcohol, vanilla, powdered sugar, peanut butter, enriched flour and pasta. Non-food items include cosmetics, soaps, detergents, shampoo, and bubble bath. Now, that's just about everything that's sold in the supermarket, just about everything that everybody buys, uses, and consumes every day are being produced with genetically modified foods. Now, that's not the whole story. Let's take a look here and see whether or not GM foods are really that good for you. Let me flip over here to page 45. Here's a little story. There's about six of these stories I want to read to you right here quickly, just little excerpts. Let's take the wisdom of the geese. There's a farmer in Illinois who's been planting soybeans on his 50-acre field for many years. Unfortunately, he also had a flock of soybean-eating geese that took up residence in a pond nearby. These geese, being creatures of habit, returned to the same spot the next year to again feast on his soybean. But this time, the geese ate only from a specific part of his field. There, as a result of their feasting, the beans grew only ankle high. The geese, it seemed, were boycotting the other part of the same field where the beans were able to grow waist high. Now, the reason for this is that this year the farmer had tried the new genetically engineered soybeans. And you can see exactly where these soybeans were planted, because there's a line right down the middle of his field with the natural beans on one side and the genetically engineered beans on the other, which were untouched by the geese. Now, visiting that Illinois farm, veteran agricultural writer C.F. Marley said, "I've never seen anything like it." Now, what's amazing is that the field with Roundup-ready genetically engineered beans had been planted to conventional beans the previous year, and the geese ate the beans the previous year this year. They will not go near that field that contains the genetic modified beans. Let's take a look at another, page 106. Listen to this. Let's try page 76 since I flipped to it. In 1998, here's called the wisdom of the cows. In 1998, Howard Vlieger harvested both natural corn and a genetically modified BT variety corn on his farm in Muncie, Iowa. Curious about how his cows would react to the pesticide-producing BT corn, he filled one side of a 16-foot trough with BT corn and then dumped natural corn on the other side. Normally, his cows would eat as much corn as was available, never leaving leftovers. But when he let 25 cows into the pen, they all congregated on the side of the trough with the natural corn. When it was gone, they nibbled a bit on the BT corn, but they quickly changed their minds and walked away. Now, 2 years later, Vlieger joined a room full of farmers in Ames, Iowa, to hear presidential candidate Al Gore. He was troubled by Gore's unquestioning acceptance of GM foods. So Vlieger asked Gore to support a recently introduced bill in Congress requiring that GM foods be labeled. Gore replied that scientists said there is no difference between GM and non-GM foods. Vlieger said he respectfully disagreed and described how his cows refused to eat the GM corn, and he added, "My cows are smarter than those scientists." The room erupted in applause. Gore asked if any other farmers noticed a difference in the way their animals responded to GM food. 12 to 15 hands went up. If a field contained GM and non-GM corn, cattle would always eat the non-GM first. Gail Lush from Nebraska. A neighbor said that he had been growing Pioneer BT corn, and when the cattle were turned out into the stocks, they just plain wouldn't eat them. That was Gary Smith of Montana. And a third farmer said, "While my cows show a preference for open pollinated corn over the hybrid varieties, they both beat BT corn hands down." Tom Eisenbiss of South Dakota. Now, according to a 1999 Acres USA article, cattle even broke through a fence and walked through a field of Roundup-ready corn to get to a non-GM variety that they ate. The cows left the GM corn untouched. Now, I want to point out, ladies and gentlemen, that as a farmer, I can testify to these facts. I want to tell you, the cows eat what they need. And when I turn cows out here into the woods, they will go through the woods and they will eat weeds. In fact, I got a neighbor over here, I was giving him some milk, and he complained about the bitter taste of the milk. And I said, "That cow is eating bitter weed because the bitter weed contains vitamins and minerals that that cow needs." And once the cows eat enough of this bitter weed, of which there's still plenty of it out there in the fields, they quit eating bitter weed when they get enough of the vitamins and minerals that they need to balance their system. And then the milk changes its flavor again. Listen to chickens. Here's some missing chickens. According to a BBC News April 27th of 2002, quote, "Safety tests on genetically modified maize currently growing in Britain were flawed. It has emerged. The crop, called T25 GM maize, that's corn, was tested in laboratory experiments on chickens. During the tests, twice as many chickens died when fed on the T25 GM maize compared with those fed on conventional maize. This research was apparently overlooked when the crop was given marketing approval in 1996. And it isn't just chickens that die eating the GM or the genetically modified maize either. Rats and mice also died when they were fed experimentally. Listen to this, the wisdom of cows and hogs. Bill Lashmet watched as two or three cows were led into a feeding area at a time. The first trough they came to contained 50 pounds of shelled BT corn. The cows sniffed it, withdrew, and walked over to the next trough, which contained 50 pounds of natural shelled corn. The cows finished it off. When they were done and released from the pen, the next group came in and they did the same thing. Lashmet said the same experiment was conducted on 6 or 7 farms in northwest Iowa in 1998 and again in 1999. Identical trials with hogs yielded the same results, also for 2 years in a row. Lashmet, who has a background in biochemistry and agriculture, says that animals have a natural sense to eat what's good for them and to avoid what isn't. He witnessed this firsthand in another experiment conducted by a feed store in Walnut Grove, Iowa. They put 23 separate vitamins and minerals, each in their own bin, out where the cows could eat them. The cows would alternate their choice of bins in such a way, according to Lashmet, that they received a balanced, healthy diet. Moreover, their preferences changed with the seasons and the climate, demonstrating a natural inclination to follow the dictates of their body's needs. And I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that that's exactly correct. As a cattleman, I can tell you that those cows, when they go out into pasture, they eat what they need. And when the milk turns bitter, they needed bitter weed and they ate it. And when the cows need onions or garlic or something else, they'll eat it and it'll come through the flavor of their milk. Now, that's what makes people mad. And they say, "Well, I don't like your milk because it tastes bad. But I like my milk because my milk comes from cows that have selective eating and they can eat whatever it is they need to balance their diets. And so I get the vitamins and minerals through the milk that the cows needed." That's the way you get perfect food. You let the animals eat naturally. And those animals will eat all the vitamins and minerals that you need, and that's the way you get vitamins and minerals in your own food supply. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here before we go any further, and that is that you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide on the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, however, are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, this book called Seeds of Deception is written by Jeffrey M. Smith. Let's see who publishes this. It's called Yes Books, P.O. Box 469, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. Yes Books is the publisher, P.O. Box 469, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. I got a phone number. It's 888. That's toll-free. That's 888-717-7000. That's 888-717-7000. Jeffrey M. Smith, Seeds of Deception, book or story on genetically modified foods, genetically engineered foods, they call them. I highly recommend it. I'm not going to review that book, this program, but I wanted to bring your attention here in this program to this subject of GM foods. It's a part of the public policy that has already been accepted in the United States. It's not going to be reversed. It's going to be accelerated. The acceleration of genetically modified foods is going to produce famine, food shortages in the United States. And I think it'll do the same thing for you people in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Now, fortunately for the people of Europe, they have rejected GM foods. Well, good for them. But for Americans, you don't have much of a choice. You no longer produce your own food, and you're now living out of the supermarket. So you're eating these GM foods, and you are a human guinea pig. Not only are you going to suffer from diseases, but you're also going to suffer from physical food shortage shortly because of this public policy. Now, there are 759 statutes, laws, and judgments in the Scripture. This includes the Ten Commandments. And these can be divided into 133 areas or subject matters for convenience. So let me cover the biblical health laws with a special eye on diet and disease. A common belief in our society is that sickness and disease are the results of luck. If you're lucky, you stay healthy. If you're unlucky, you get sick. Well, at the turn of the century, medicine divided into two main camps. We call them allopathic medicine and holistic medicine. The allopathic camp won the struggle, and our society as a whole subscribes to this allopathic theory of diseases and their cures. Now, the problem with this is that allopathic medicine is a reactive, not a proactive form of treatment. For example, allopathic medicine treats the symptoms of the disease. It does not treat the cause. Now, in order for you to treat the cause of a disease, you need to know what caused that disease in the first place. So at the risk of sounding simplistic, I contend that the primary cause of disease is sin. In this case, I'm defining sin as the transgression of the law. And you'll see that in Leviticus 26, verses 14 through 46, in Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 through 68, for the causes of disease. In John 3, verse 4, that is 1 John 3, verse 4, you'll see the definition of sin, for this is sin, it's the transgression of the law. And also take a look at Leviticus 26, verses 16 and verse 25, and then Deuteronomy 28, verses 21 and 22, verses 27 and 28, verse 35, verse 45, and verses 59 through 61. And it'll tell you a little more to the story. Now, in many cases, disease is caused by a nutritional deficiency, a toxic buildup in the body, or some combination of these two. Now, in the case of nutritional deficiency, our failure to practice the land Sabbaths and Jubilee years, among other things, has led to a gradual lessening of the nutritional values of the food that we eat, a lessening which has been so long in coming that in most cases even the experts do not notice the differences unless they're specifically looking for them. Think of it like a hillside being eroded at 1/10 of an inch a year. For us to see any difference, you'll need pictures taken decades, even centuries apart. For people who say that nutrition is important, but lack of nutrition cannot cause really major life-threatening diseases, I'd like to point you to scurvy, which is caused by a lack of vitamin C, and rickets, which is caused by a lack of vitamin D. That's just a couple of examples of nutritionally based diseases, which even the allopathic medicine or medical doctors will acknowledge. Now, if you look at the list of diseases which can be alleviated or completely cured by proper nutrition or carefully administered nutritional therapy, it's a lot harder to stop being sick than it is to get sick in the first place. It's a pretty long list. As for toxins causing disease, that's poison, you need to look beyond the obvious cases of poisoning to see the scope of the problem. Nutritional deficiency is caused by not putting something into your body that your body needs to survive and or to be healthy. Toxic buildup or poisoning, on the other hand, is caused by putting something into your body that will prevent your body from surviving and or being healthy. Such things range from tar and nicotine, which cause lung cancer, meat that comes from carnivorous herbivores, this can cause new variant Creutzfeldt-Jacobs disease, also known as the human version of mad cow disease, fat. How many articles have you seen telling you to cut down on the fat consumption in your diet because it causes heart disease? Well, the list goes on and on. Now, the interesting thing is that scriptural dietary laws forbid taking into your body these poisons. And yet, each and every day, people blithely smoke while eating greasy hamburgers from McDonald's. And yet they wonder, why am I sick? Well, those dietary laws were put there for a reason. They're put there to prevent disease. Now, if you look at these groups which adhere, whether knowingly or unknowingly, to most or all of these scriptural dietary laws, you will see significantly lower rates of these common degenerative diseases and a higher life expectancy in general among these groups or populations of people. Now, when you deal with the subject of communicable diseases, ranging from the common cold through the plague, you know, bubonic plague, for instance, you'll find that most people get sick not so much from the disease as from a weakened immune system, which cannot protect you. So when I talk about disease in this sense, I'm not talking about the 1 or 2 day sniffles. I'm talking about the 1 or 2 week flat on your back flu or worse. And even allopathic medicine recognizes to a certain extent the importance of nutrition in fighting disease. Look how they've pushed vitamin C over the past 30 years. But having and keeping a healthy immune system requires more than just popping a few vitamin tablets every day and then saying, well, I'm protected now. Guess I'll go out for that shrimp and hamburger special down at Captain D's. You see, no amount of vitamin popping is going to protect you from yourself and from the penalties that you suffer for eating poorly and in violation of the law. Now, some people are going to say this is BS. People are living longer today than they ever have before. Well, I know life expectancy in the industrialized countries, for instance, North America, Europe, and Japan today is longer than it has been in the past, at least in the past 2,000 years or so, but there isn't any real knowledge about how long people live prior to that. Remember, the Bible and the histories of various people around the world note some pretty impressive lifespans. And in addition, scientists, at least the honest ones at least, will note that the vast majority of the lifespan increases over the past 100 years have been the results of the significant lowering of infant and child mortality rates, mostly due to increased sanitation and emergency treatment. Now, the chance that a person who makes it to 40 these days will make it to 60 or 80 isn't substantially any different than it was in 1900. The majority of the difference is due to trauma care. And besides, if you're like George Burns and you live to be 100 while smoking cigars and eating who knows what, can you imagine how long you might live if you took care of yourself and avoided both acute and short-term, and that is short-term and chronic or long-term diseases? Now, I know this runs counter to the conventional wisdom that everything is bigger and better these days, but that there's just more of it. But let's face it, the majority of our improved health care today really comes down to the single big shining success of allopathic medicine, and that's trauma care. There's no disputing that you have a much greater chance of surviving a traumatic injury now than you would have just 20 years ago, much less 50, 75, or 100 years ago. But much of what passes for improved modern medicine is simply the application of trauma care to everything. How do most doctors and hospitals treat a cold, assuming they don't try to pump you full of antibiotics? A practice roundly condemned by both the AMA and the Center for Disease Control, as it creates the so-called super germs. Well, what they do is they send you home with a recommendation for bed rest, plenty of liquids and some vitamin C, and then chicken soup. Well, hell, that's not any different from what grandma used to do. And then for the really nasty diseases like plague, the usual course of treatment is to simply try and prevent you from dying and let your body do the healing. That's where your immune system comes in. And if your body isn't up to the task, it's very simple. You just die. Even if you're in the biggest and best hospital in the world, you just die. If your body won't do the healing, you're going to die. If your immune system doesn't work, you die right there in the biggest and best hospitals. And if you don't believe me, just break out some of the articles on the people who died during the recent anthrax scare. You know, the ones who made it to the hospital were given the best of everything. And in spite of all of their knowledge and effort, the doctors would usually come out in a few days and say, well, there wasn't anything they could do because the anthrax had made it to the lungs. Well, now, okay, you say, why would my body, nourished by the fruits of the Green Revolution and the best diet in history, just give up? Well, I'm glad you asked that. Because do I have some good information for you? This Green Revolution is pretty much a fake. The agricultural equivalent to puffed wheat. If you go back to 1880, the protein content of Kansas wheat was 24%. By 1950, generally considered the start of the Green Revolution, it had dropped to an average of 18%. Now that's a 25% loss. And right now, the same Kansas wheat is running 7 to 13%. That's a 50 to 75% loss over a 120-year span. Now, this is directly attributable to two things. The overuse of the land, which I mentioned to you, this is in the first program there, we talked about this thing of overuse of the land or soil erosion. And the failure to practice the land Sabbath and other land stewardship laws from the scripture. And two, the use of hybrid or genetically modified seed. Now, look at Leviticus 19, verse 19, and Leviticus chapter 25 for more information on this. That is, hybridizing your seed, that's where genetic modification comes in. It's not just genetic modification. Hybridizing has been going on for a long time, but now we're taking it to a new and higher level, guaranteed by public policy to give us just exactly what we don't want, and that's famine. And don't just take my word for this. Why don't you listen to what Acres USA has to say on the matter? And that is this, quote, some of the successes that have attended corn production in the Green Revolution may have been the result of distorted accounting procedures. Because in terms of nutrients, open pollinated corn still has a very enviable record. Adolf Steinbrom of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter in perspective by having samples of corn tested for ingredients that are usually added to commercial feeds. When compared to some 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a single year, Steinbrom's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, and 205% more manganese, and the same trend has also been seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. And in the opinion of many ecologic farmers, hybrid corn merely masks poor farming by producing bins and bushels without the nutrients that are really corn's reason for being. And an Acres USA primer by Charles Walters says, every commercial food crop in this country has a similar nutritional deficiency. I want to repeat that. Every commercial food crop in the United States of America has a similar nutritional deficiency, which comes directly from this hybridization. Now, when we add to the hybridization the chemical fertilizers and the pesticides that we need to go along with it, we have an agricultural system which is built upon the industrial model. Agriculture, boys and girls, is a biologic process. It is not an industrial process. And when we try to turn agriculture into an industrial process, which we have done as a matter of public policy, the multinational corporations, the John Deere Corporation, Monsanto, these big multinational corporations, the seed manufacturers or the seed growers, have turned agriculture into an industrial process. And every place that this has been tried produces food shortages. This was tried in Russia. I remember in Russia a few years ago, they had a dual system. They had the state-run industrial agricultural process called communal farms, big state enterprises. And they produced about one half of all of the food that they consumed in the Soviet Union. On the other half, these peasants that used to be landowners, private landowners, were given one half acre of land to produce whatever it is they wanted after they finished working on the state commune. And they produced the other one half of the food produced in the Soviet Union. Half the food that was produced on the one half acre plots, which comprised about 10% of the land being used in Russia. 90% of the land produced the other one half. And one day I put my amazing Gordon mind to this problem, and I said, you know, if you want to solve the food shortage in Russia, it's very simple. Just double the amount of land that these peasants have, from a half acre to 1 acre, and they will produce all of the food that the Russians need to eat, and the state can then export the other half that they're producing and make a ton of money on it. I don't know why those Russians didn't figure that out. I mean, you know, just common sense tell you that. So the farmers on the one-half-acre plots produced as much as all the rest of the country and all the state farms combined. Now, if you look at the statistics of men who suffer from heart attacks, the monthly reports on the newest food not to eat, and the increasing number of incidents involving hospitalization even death, from tainted food? I'd say the answer is pretty obvious. And as for eating the best diet in history, I'm going to ask you, if it's so damn good, you know, if the diet of the average American is so damn good that the government, doctors, etc., are trying to get us to change our eating habits because we suffer from so many diet-related diseases like heart attacks. Everywhere you look, you run into some catch-22. Are they lying about the American diet being the best, or are they lying about the risks inherent from eating that American diet? Tomorrow I'm going to take you through an interesting story here called Super Size Me, put out by a young fellow who actually ate a McDonald's diet. His name is Morgan Spurlock. He ate McDonald's for 30 days. Started out in perfect health. He got through in 30 days. His health was substantially impaired. I'll give you some of the facts and figures and tell you that story next time. Now, while you can't completely escape the damage done by this diet, this is the American diet after all, you've been eating this American diet all your life and living the American lifestyle, you can, however, prevent the damage from getting any worse. You know, I don't care how fat you are. I don't care how poor a health you're in right now. You can stop where you're at right now and turn that around. But if you continue on doing what you're doing, you can expect to get more of the same. If you weigh 350 pounds, and you're eating at McDonald's twice a week, do you believe that eating at McDonald's four times a week is going to cut your weight in half? I mean, why don't you test it? I mean, you know, give yourself the benefit of the doubt. If you're overweight or you're in bad health, take a look at the food that you're eating right now. Double it. And see if it improves your health or makes it worse. If it makes it worse, wouldn't that tell you that half as much maybe makes you half as sick, and maybe if you stopped eating that diet altogether, you might get well? I know it's a wild new concept, but I'm going to show you what happened to this guy, Morgan Spurlock, when he went on a McDonald's-only diet for 30 days. Ate nothing but McDonald's for 30 days. I'll show you that in the next program. Well, you may want to ask how. Well, for starters, the Mosaic Law contains a detailed listing of not just dietary laws, but health laws in general. Some have been followed in this country for many years, but many of them are going to be brand new for you. So as we talk about this thing of the coming famine, we're also going to talk about the famine that's already here. The famine in America, where the food we eat has anywhere from 50 to 75% of the nutritive value destroyed by the growing process. I mean, the food that you're eating today is only half the nutrient value of the food that you were eating 100 years ago. And that's why you're sick. Well, we're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. Let me give you a reminder that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. Well, we're out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and good night, friends.